I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. North Korea conducted its third underground nuclear test and got a mention in President Obama's State of the Union speech. The president also mentioned Iran and its nuclear ambitions and said, "We'll engage Russia to seek further reductions in our nuclear arsenals." It's been almost 70 years since the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on two Japanese cities during the Second World War, setting the stage for the nuclear age. Our guest Ward Wilson argues in his new book that conventional thinking about the threat and power of nuclear weapons has been flawed, and it's led to wrong-headed conclusions. The book, which was decades in the making, is titled Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Ward Wilson is a senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Ward Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Are you one of those duck and cover kids as I was?
I was just too young to be duck and cover, but I remember seeing all the pictures in history books, and I can't imagine what they were thinking about having children practice for nuclear war.
But it did feed a kind of fear in the 1950s, a fear about the threat of nuclear annihilation.
Yeah, well, people who practiced those drills remember them very vividly, and I can remember seeing the black and yellow signs around my hometown where you would run in the event of a nuclear attack, and a nuclear attack was something that supposedly could happen at any time. And it gets your attention.
It sure does. This is not to embarrass you at all, but this book was a long time in the making, and I'm just curious why.
I came to a lot of unusual conclusions, and it's relatively easy to write a book that goes along with what everyone else thinks. But when I got down into the facts and started digging into the history, what I found is that a lot of it seemed to me to be wrong. So then I had to figure out what I thought and how I got there and what the facts were. And so it took a considerable amount of time.
Well, let's start with some of these myths. And I would say, based on my reading of your book, that the major myth, and perhaps a myth that gave birth to these other myths that you write about, was that the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended the Second World War in the Pacific. And you say, not true.
It doesn't appear to be so. The Japanese said they surrendered because of the bomb, but if you look at the facts, it's pretty obvious that they surrendered because the Soviet Union came into the war on the night of August 8th, 9th, 1945, which is 2 days after Hiroshima and midnight before the morning of Nagasaki. And the evidence for this is mostly emerged in the last 20 years. A bunch of historians have gone into archives in Japan and Russia and the U.S., and what they find is that all of the evidence, really, if you look at it without imagining that it's going to tell you that the bombing was the reason they surrendered, it all seems to point to the fact that the Russian intervention created a crisis. Of course, the Russians had been neutral, and then they decided they were going to invade and join the war, and it touched off a crisis.
But if that is the myth, how has that, I guess, created a misunderstanding about nuclear weapons?
Well, it's done two things. One is, you know, you got to think about it. Most weapons get field tested a lot, and a lot of times it takes a long time to figure out what the implications of a weapon are, so that in World War I, no one knew what machine guns, what kind of effect they were going to have on the battlefield until they'd been used for almost 2 or 3 years. Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the only times that nuclear weapons have actually been used in war. So any conclusions that you draw from that use then affect everything else that you think. It's, you know, having only one piece of data to go on, and from my perspective, getting that piece of data wrong can really affect what you think.
You have some really, I have to say, chilling photographs in the book, and some of them are of what Hiroshima and Nagasaki looked like after the bombing, but you also include photos of other cities that had been bombed with conventional through conventional warfare, and they look equally as devastated.
A lot of people don't realize that in the summer of 1945, the U.S. bombed 68 Japanese cities. Most of them were on average 50% destroyed. There were something like 15 cities that weren't bombed, so we had pretty much covered all the possibilities, and a few of them that we hadn't bombed were on Hokkaido, which is the northernmost island. We couldn't reach them. And so the conventional destruction, in some cases, was there are three graphs in the book. If you graph all 68 city attacks and you chart the number of people killed, Hiroshima, you would imagine, would be off the charts because that's the way we always talk about it. In fact, it's second. Tokyo, a conventional attack, kills more. If you graph the square miles destroyed, Hiroshima is sixth. If you graph the percentage of the city destroyed, Hiroshima is 17th. Toyama, a city the size of Chattanooga in 1940 or so, was 99.5% destroyed. So the conventional raids were enormously destructive.
Another thing you say, and you know, this is, it's hard to talk about warfare in such clinical terms, but nonetheless, one of the things that you say is that countries win wars when military or armies or air force defeat each other. It isn't about killing civilians, as horrible as that is.
Think about it. In the American Civil War, the South didn't surrender when Atlanta was burned or when Richmond was captured and also partially burned. They surrendered when Robert E. Lee surrendered and when Johnston's army was surrounded in South Carolina. So, and after Hiroshima had been bombed, there were still something like 1 million Japanese soldiers dug in on the beaches of the Japanese home islands ready to fight against invaders. And they had lost one, you know, more city behind them, but they had been losing cities on average one every other day for the entire summer. And so it just, you know, it is too bad that leaders don't seem to care that much about. Mm-hmm. But there's never been, Hitler didn't surrender because of, Winston Churchill didn't surrender because civilians were being killed, so on.
Do you think, though, there's something about that image of the mushroom cloud, that powerful image that has led us to think about nuclear weapons as this incredible destructive force, which of course it is?
It's clearly physically enormously powerful. And the mushroom cloud probably helps, and the giant flash of light and so on. I'm guessing that the key thing was that Japan surrendered. We used two, and 3 days later, they surrendered. And in the first kind of semi-official pronouncement about this by Henry Stimson, who was Secretary of War, he says, you know, we tried to organize this so that we could shock them, and they apparently were. It's a psychological weapon. And I think people just concluded, it's a miracle weapon. It can force people to surrender after only two uses.
And you're saying not so fast.
Well, the Japanese if you look at what they, after the war, they said, oh, yeah, we surrendered because of the bomb. And the emperor said so in his radio speech. But think about it. Put yourself in Hirohito's shoes. What do you want to say at the end of the war? Do you want to say, well, we made some mistakes, and it was a dumb war to go into, and we shouldn't have done it, and the Army and the Navy could never coordinate when they were fighting together, and so we had problems? Or would you rather say, the enemy made an amazing scientific breakthrough. No one could have predicted it, and that's why we lost. It's not our fault.
And do you think the U.S., in a sense, bought into that? Or we had our own reasons for saying why we thought these two bombings won the war?
We wanted it to be true. We'd spent $2.2 billion in 1942 dollars. And we were worried about the severity of city bombing. We wanted that to be the reason why they surrendered.
You also write about the Cuban Missile Crisis, a crisis I do remember. I think I was in seventh grade, and I remember my Mr. Neuenhertz, my history teacher, describing, you know, what was happening. But you say we came pretty darn close to another nuclear attack during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Cuban Missile Crisis is Exhibit A in the argument about nuclear deterrence. And people who, proponents of nuclear weapons, say, see, it proves nuclear deterrence works because the Soviets put missiles into Cuba. There was a risk of nuclear war, and then they took them out. But what people don't talk about so much is, what about JFK? JFK knew that if he blockaded the island, there was a risk of nuclear war, and yet he went ahead and blockaded the island. And now we know, in a recent book by Michael Dobbs, excellent book called 1 Minute to Midnight, he talks about three different occasions when we were within a hair's breadth of nuclear war. The one that makes my hair stand on end the most is a U-2 that strayed off course at the height of the crisis and went 300 miles into Russia. And the Soviets scramble MiGs to shoot it down, and we scramble fighters to find it and escort it back, except that it's the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so the U.S. Fighters have all had their regular missiles removed, and they've been replaced with nuclear missiles. It's the only armament they have on board, and if they had run into the Soviets, they'd have used nuclear missiles over Russia, which probably would have led to nuclear war pretty quickly. So,
but it obviously didn't happen.
No, they didn't fight each other. Yeah.
But are you saying that's just luck, or that somehow, you know, at this brink of possible nuclear war, these two countries pulled back?
Well,
or just an accident of history?
I think that there are two forces at work in any crisis. There's the anger and the determination that drives you forward, and there's the fear of the consequences that pulls you back. And I think both were at work in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so you can, if you look around, you can find instances of people saying, oh, gee, we'd better be more cautious. But the fact is, we waded into this crisis, and Robert Kennedy wrote in his memoir of his brother's of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that his brother initiated the crisis, but he was no longer in control of it. There were thousands of soldiers all across the Caribbean and around the world who, you know, if they'd been having a bad day, they might have started a nuclear war.
We're almost up on a break here, but there was, of course, with the U.S. and the USSR, this notion of mutually assured destruction, that if we have our nuclear weapons, you have yours, we're not going to use them against each other. But you're saying, again, another myth?
Well, mutually assured destruction is great as long as it works absolutely perfectly. Because, you know, when you have a failure, the potential result is a catastrophic nuclear war. And the research in the book, what it indicates to me, is that throughout the Cold War, in a series of crises, there were failures of nuclear deterrence. None of them led to nuclear war, but they're clear failures of nuclear deterrence. And if the failure rate for nuclear deterrence is high, then I don't want to rely on it for my safety and security, because that means it could fail catastrophically.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Ward Wilson, and we're talking about his new book, and it's called, very simply, 5 Myths About Nuclear Weapons. We are talking about those myths and how they have endured. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia, and Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra continue their seasons with Beethoven and Gill, featuring Beethoven's Choral Fantasy, Symphony No. 2, and Fidelio Overture, including a world premiere by Jeremy Gill and award-winning pianist Ching Yun Hu, Saturday and Sunday, February 23rd and 24th at the Philadelphia Episcopal Cathedral. Tickets available online at mcchorus.org. mcchorus.org.
The violence in Chicago is in the news, but for the students and staff at the city's Harper High School, there's nothing new about it.
There's a war zone around now. Our opposition is right down the street, literally it's on the next block.
What you've probably never heard about Chicago's gang and youth violence, that's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ward Wilson. He's a senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Quite a mouthful. Also author of a new book called Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. That's what we're talking about. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to move on to some of these other myths, but first, let me get Patrick from South Philadelphia to join us. And Patrick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I was just calling to say that at least in my historical opinion about the object of the war, as far as the bombing campaign on Japan, was not necessarily to kill civilians, as unfortunately they had to, but to shut down the war effort of Japan. I was wondering what Ward's comments were about that. Specifically about not having to, you know, fight the army head on.
Fair enough. Patrick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You want to take that?
One of the problems with Hiroshima is that there's a lot emotionally at stake, both for Japan and the United States, because it's become part of our national historical stories. And so people often, for 40 years, there's been a debate among historians about whether or not Hiroshima was necessary. And that's fine, but that's a separate debate. What I'm really interested in is this kind of pragmatic, did the bombing work? Did it force Japan to surrender? I think that the Air Force officers that were part of the bombing were convinced that they were trying to win the war, that their goal was to, you know, destroy economic resources or shock Japan's leadership or whatever it was. And so I think that's they were clearly convinced that they were working on a military mission. But part of the problem with nuclear weapons is that they are so clumsy. You want to blow up a single building in a city with a nuclear weapon, and you have to destroy three quarters of the city to do it. So,
Patrick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You also raised questions about the H-bomb that was developed in the 1950s.
There's this whole thing in the literature that the H-bomb is thousands of times more powerful. And it kind of depends on the way you measure it. And I've had long discussions with physicists. And my problem was that when I thought about it, you always see these maps of cities with concentric circles that show the levels of damage. And my historian's mind, when people say the H-bomb is thousands of times bigger, then I imagine that those circles are thousands of times larger. But in fact, the circle with the most damage, the 5 PSI circle, where there's 5 pounds of overpressure, of blast overpressure at the center of the explosion. And Hiroshima, the radius of that circle was 0.8 miles. 0.8 miles. So in a 1 megaton bomb, which you might imagine, which in terms of yield is 62 times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb, the 5 PSI circle is only, the radius of it is only 6 times bigger. So it's complicated, but the point is we don't measure destruction when we talk about yield of nuclear weapons. What we measure is the weight of the equivalent amount of TNT, the weight of the TNT necessary to create an equivalent explosion, which is a peculiar – I mean, would you talk about the horsepower of a car by talking about the weight of the horses necessary to create an equivalent – I don't know. The point is – there's this idea that the H-bomb created a quantum leap in destructive power. The fact is the size of the explosions created by U.S. warheads has been steadily shrinking for 40 years. War planners have said, we want smaller warheads.
But are you also making an argument that if nuclear weapons are not as destructive or, frankly, as horrible as we thought, that perhaps we could live with them?
The thing about nuclear weapons they have so many limitations, but the most important one is radiation. Every time you use a nuclear weapon, you spread this poison downwind, and some percentage of the poison lasts for hundreds or thousands of years. And that's just the nature of nuclear explosions. You can't get around that. Even if you could make a really small, really selective, targetable nuclear weapon, you're still going to end up with this poison that, and the wind blows from different directions. You can't control where it goes, and they're a mess.
But we haven't had World War III. I mean, thank goodness. We've had lots of small, sometimes proxy wars all over the world. But we haven't had superpowers, especially nuclear superpowers, fighting each other.
True.
Do the fact that not just the U.S. and now Russia, but the Soviet Union has nuclear weapons, does that have anything to do with keeping the peace between some of these big powers?
I'm sure. Ordinary deterrence, like keeping kids from stealing cookies or deterring people from becoming criminals, works some of the time. Although people, even in states with the death penalty, people still murder other people. So it doesn't work all the time. And I'm sure nuclear deterrence works some of the time. Nuclear war is a scary enough prospect that, you know, it's hard to imagine that it doesn't work some of the time. Problem with nuclear weapons is some of the time isn't good enough. It has to be perfect because any failure could end up with a catastrophic war. And what nuclear theorists have tried to argue in the past is that it's so scary that it must be perfect. But the evidence shows it hasn't been.
Yeah.
So
you also talk about something called the genie effect. And frankly, I'm feeling it right now, which the idea is that we have created these weapons. We have used this technology. We're in the nuclear age. You know, there are countries and there are terrorist organizations, they want to get their hand on this, and that we can't, I think using one of your words, disinvent nuclear weapons.
Right.
We can't put this stuff back into the ground. But you're saying, well, maybe we can.
Well, what I'm saying is that the genie argument has won debates for 50 years because it's very powerful, because it's absolutely true. You can't disinvent technology. But the trick is that's actually not how technology goes out of existence. We don't disinvent dumb technology. It just falls out of use. You remember those bicycles with one really big wheel in front and one little wheel?
Sort of, yeah.
I don't mean personally.
No, I don't.
You've probably seen.
But I know what you're talking about.
When they were really difficult to get up on, and they were dangerous to fall off of, but no one said, you know, you can't stuff the penny farthing genie back in the bottle. What they said was, gee, here are these better bicycles with two wheels the same size. Let's use them. And then they gave up the old technology. So I think that it is absolutely true that you can't disinvent nuclear technology, but we need to rethink that because there are lots of ways that technology goes out of existence. And we've actually banned chemical weapons and biological weapons, both of which share some of the clumsiness and the messiness of nuclear weapons. The problem with chemical weapons is they used them a lot in World War I, and they found they don't give you any advantage particularly. And they're just really hard to use on the battlefield.
And you're saying the same thing for nuclear weapons.
I talked to military guys, and some of them quite senior. I talked to a man who was responsible for the defense of South Korea at one point. And obviously, at one time, that involved nuclear weapons. And a lot of those military men say, oh, nuclear weapons, we hate them, you know, because they mess up the battlefield and they don't give you any, because so you fire a nuclear weapon into a region, then it's very difficult to send your troops in there. But you can't stop guarding it because the other guy might be crazy enough to send his troops through it. Mm. So, in fact, the interesting thing about this, and this is why history is so useful, Ike wanted to use nuclear weapons in Korea, but they decided against it. In part because Korea has lots of narrow valleys, I'm guessing. And you might be able to blow up a Chinese brigade in this valley, and then they would, then the one in the next valley would be fine. They were concerned that if you use nuclear weapons in Korea and they didn't immediately win the war, it would undercut people's sense of the power of nuclear deterrence.
And that's Ward Wilson, our guest today on Radio Times, author of Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It's interesting that Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, that there have been very influential, very high-powered members of government who are opposed to nuclear weapons. President Obama talked about that when he was a candidate. He has made mention of that as well. So there, it's interesting that there's this powerful group of people that, that want to figure out how to get us off and out of the nuclear weapons age.
I think people who confront the reality of nuclear weapons and nuclear war, it changes them. I had a chance to talk to a guy who was the head of Strategic Air Command at one time. And he's now, he's a four-star Air Force general. He's now a real opponent of nuclear weapons. And I think what changed his mind, every month they had a practice drill where they talked about, they had a practice nuclear war. And he went through that experience. And I'm not surprised that former officials often come out and say, we've got to do something about this.
Former officials. I mean, does it help to be a former official, do you think?
They don't seem to talk about it much while they're in office because they worry that they'll lose their jobs, I guess. I don't know.
Well, let me quote something from Senator Jeff Sessions. He's a Republican from Alabama, and I don't mean this as a partisan comment here, but in response to the president talking about reducing our nuclear arsenal, he said, it doesn't totally surprise me because I believe he, Mr. Obama, comes out of the anti-nuclear left. I mean, are we still fighting these battles?
For 60 years, there were two camps. There were the idealists, who said, oh, it's immoral and terrible to use nuclear weapons, which absolutely is true. And the realists who said, yes, but you can't put the genie back in the bottle and we need them and they increase our power and influence in the world. And so people are used to thinking in these terms of realist and idealist. One of the things that confuses people about the book that I wrote is that it is fundamentally a very pragmatic approach. I'm not arguing for morality or idealism. I just say, look, I'm not sure they're great weapons.
Let me get some more callers in. Looks like we have Mary from Overbrook joining us on Radio Times. And Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Ward. This is Mary. I actually lectured with you a couple of years ago.
Hello, Mary.
At Hampshire College.
Oh, goodness gracious. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was calling because I hear you saying that based on history, multilateral engagement is a stronger tool in large conflicts than nuclear weapons. But in recent years, in small conflicts, we've been using low-yield weapons, like robust nuclear bunker busters, and thus creating a precedent for using low-yield nuclear weapons on the battlefield. And I was wondering if you could comment on this practice, and also if you could comment on alternatives to this practice.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead, Ward.
So in the Bush administration, they talked a lot about building bunker busters, building smaller nuclear weapons, about a third the size of the weapons we had at the time, and something else, which I've forgotten. And in my view, none of those notions made much sense. One of the problems with bunker busters is that it's relatively easy to dig deeper. They only give you down to about 300 meters, even the very powerful nuclear weapons. And, it's easy to dig deeper than that. The other thing is, if you're going to blow up a bunker, that means you know where it is. If you know where it is, you know where it is because you found the door. If you found the door, you can just blow up the door. Once you've blown up the door, they can't get out of the bunker. So, in any case. But I think what's interesting about what Mary says is that there is this trend in war towards smaller, more precise, more intelligent weapons. And the U.S. increasingly has been able to use precision-guided munitions in its conflicts. And many people don't like them because they kill innocent civilians.
We're talking about drones, I guess.
Drones included, right. Yes. But the fact is, drones kill a lot fewer civilians than, for instance, a nuclear weapon would. I saw a picture on the internet of a guy holding what was called the Black Hornet Nano. It's 4 inches long. It's a tiny little helicopter with a camera on it. and they fly it around a battlefield, and they can look, soldiers can look behind buildings and see, you know, what they're trying to fight against. It seems to me that's the future of warfare, and that nuclear weapons increasingly look like the outmoded weapons of the past, big and blundering, but not all that useful.
Mary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. President Obama has talked, or apparently is talking, with Russia, and I know the START treaty of I guess, a couple of years ago, the goal is to reduce the nuclear arsenal. How many nuclear weapons does the U.S. have? Do you know?
Oh, dear. I think it's I think we currently have 1,500 on active. The problem with the arsenal is that there's the ones that are ready to go.
Right. 24/7, ready to go, right?
And then there's a certain number that are getting disassembled but haven't been disassembled yet, and there's some that are kind of in storage reserve and being refurbished, and so it's a complicated number to really pin down. But President Obama has been talking about going down to 1,100 or even just 1,000 nuclear weapons, and they've been talking about doing it without a treaty because they had so much trouble with the New START treaty. I think they found is that there wasn't very much public interest.
That's interesting.
And but the people who work on nuclear weapons and the factories and the, you know, facilities and the nuclear power, they were all deeply interested because their jobs were at stake. And so President Obama ended up promising $185 billion of improvements to the nuclear facility as a way of, I think, preventing the heads of the various nuclear labs from opposing the treaty, because the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was blocked in part because two of the labs, the heads of the labs, came out against it. So,
do you worry about nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorist organizations?
Oh, sure. Nuclear weapons are ideal terror weapons.
Ideal.
Yeah. What could be a better terror weapon than to be able to blow up an entire city? And what I often say to people is that if we want to ensure that terrorists one day get a hold of nuclear weapons, what we should do is continue on exactly as we're going now. Because more countries slowly are getting nuclear weapons. The more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more people there are who might be selling them out the back door to whomever.
There are concerns even with the arsenals in Russia, just how protected, how safe are they? Are they really padlocked and people aren't spiriting some of that stuff out the back door?
We spent a lot of money to try and help the Russians when they went from being the Soviet Union to being the Russian Federation to help them lock down their nuclear materials, all of them. But Russia isn't the most – the Pakistan is the country that a lot of people discuss and are worried about because – you know, it's less. It seems to be less politically stable, and so.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Ward Wilson, and we're talking about a new book. It has been several decades in the making, but nonetheless, it is published, and it's called Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. We're talking about these various myths and what, frankly, can be done about nuclear weapons. And he is also at the Monterey Institute. And we have some callers waiting to join us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which premiered in Paris a century ago. This centennial is a collaboration with dancers, images projected above the orchestra, and dramatic lighting. Tickets at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, The Rite of Spring Centennial with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Child expert Nancy Carlson Page isn't totally against violent movies. She's against toys from them sold to little kids, which is why her son Matt Damon won't let his image be marketed. Also, where does our chef go for inspiration? Well, dreams for one. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY. Their annual rug event ends Saturday, featuring the Fair Trade Bunyad Rug Collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with historian Ward Wilson. He's a senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. That's at the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and author of this new book we've been talking about called Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Tom from Absecon, New Jersey, to join us. Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, folks.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to say that I was a Cold War kid. I went through all the duck and cover. Used to wake up in the middle of the night every time I heard a siren, a cold sweat. I mean, it was a very tough time. And all through my life, I had a great interest in researching this, and I've watched probably every movie that ever came out, every documentary that ever came out. The things that come to mind are Some of All Fears, The Day After.
Sure.
The Peacemaker, Crimson Tide, and when you look at those, you could actually see, well, I think the Some of All, Day After was the only one that actually depicted the, where they actually pressed the button, but when you see that, you say, you know, I think that those movies had a great deal to do with from us observing those movies and our enemies, or our opponents, as you might say, maybe being a deterrent.
Well, this,
could you give me your opinion on that?
Tom, it's an interesting point. Go ahead.
Well, there's no question that the cultural stuff surrounding nuclear weapons feeds into how we feel about them, and how we feel about them affects whether or not we, whether or not leaders are deterred or not in a crisis. It's interesting, actually, because one of the things about that fear that people feel is that they often talk about nuclear war in terms of apocalypse, or if you think about it, the word that we use for nuclear war, we could call it super science war, but in fact what we call it is the name of a hill in Israel that is supposedly the site of the last battle at the end of days. We call it Armageddon.
Yeah.
And there's all this apocalyptic talk that goes with nuclear war. And I think in some ways that the fear probably reinforces deterrence a little bit, but in some ways it also doesn't help, because the action item, the effective moving part about apocalypse is that it is entirely in God's hands.
And we're helpless,
and
right?
We're helpless. The only thing you can do is pray. And so thinking about nuclear war as apocalypse makes you less inclined to do anything about it. I always tell people that I imagine nuclear war would be like the darkest ages ever. They might last for thousands of, you know, instead of the dark ages, you'd have thousands of years of primitive. So
thanks for the call to Radio Times, Tom. You do say, I mean, you say several things, which is, I'm not sure what can and should be done about nuclear weapons. That's a quote from your book. But you also talk about a nuclear pause. And the question is, you know, how do you get, I know you've spoken at the UN recently, but how do you get the world to agree on a nuclear pause? And there are countries that have given up their nuclear weapons. We're not among them yet. But how do you get the world to decide that this is a good thing to do?
There are two. One is, the interesting thing is that we live in a nuclear armed country. And we often imagine that everyone really wants nuclear weapons. They're just too poor or not smart enough to be able to make them. The fact is, more nations have had nuclear weapons and given them up, or had nuclear weapons programs and abandoned them, than actually have built nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. It's roughly 12 to 9. There are 9 nuclear states, and there are 12, depending on how you count, 12, 15 countries that have thought about building nuclear weapons and then said, ah, forget it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most important step is to rethink nuclear weapons. The biggest problem we have is that our debates are all full of these ideas that aren't based on the facts. And the most important step is for everyone to, you know, sit back and reevaluate and say, are these really useful weapons? Mm. Do we really want them? You know, because if nuclear weapons are magic, then we'll never get rid of them, and we can never, and proliferation is irresistible. But if they're just clumsy, old, outmoded, messy weapons that, you know, remind us more of dinosaurs than anything else, that's a different conversation when you're talking about getting rid of them.
Could you say that to the Iranians? I mean, they say they're developing nuclear energy, but it's clearly the technology is similar for nuclear weapons. They certainly are acting like they want nuclear weapons.
A friend of mine is organizing a conference and hoping to get funding to bring U.S. strategists and Iranian strategists to London, and then to several months later to have the same conference in Tehran. And he asked me if I would come, and I'd be happy to.
Right. But would that be your message? I mean,
sure.
to a country or an individual that wanted nuclear weapons, saying this is clumsy dinosaur weaponry?
Absolutely. What has happened with countries that got nuclear weapons is that they were all excited while they were building them, and then they get them, and they realize there's not that much you can – you know, if nuclear weapons were going to allow Iran to dominate the Middle East, why didn't they allow Israel to dominate the Middle East since – you know, the early 70s when they developed them. You know, it's just they're big, dangerous weapons that don't have many uses.
Well, and whether they're defensive uses or offensive uses, I mean, obviously that's a different use of a nuclear weapon, whether you feel like you're there to defend yourself or whether you have, you know, aggression on your mind.
The problem with nuclear weapons is that particularly in a confined space like the Middle East, you use them offensively, and if the wind is blowing the wrong way, they come back on you. So it's not always as easy to work out what's offensive and what's defensive.
Let me get looks like Will from Northern Liberties to join us, and we'll go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
My question, you touched on it a little bit earlier in the show. I was wondering, Professor Wilson, can't you make a very compelling argument that in the long series of weapons that were supposed to be too horrible to use, Nobel with dynamite, Gatling with the early Gatling gun, Oppenheimer with the nuclear weapon, can't you really make an argument that since both those prior examples were used in a very large scale in a very short span of time after their invention, and nuclear weapons have been used only twice in combat, can't you make a very, very strong argument that they do work in terms of deterrence, not in necessarily practical use, but in that we've built something that everyone's a little freaked out to use, and it makes everybody hesitate. And I'll take my answer off there.
Will, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
There's no question that nuclear weapons are scary and people are impressed by them. But if you look at the evidence of the Cold War crises, they weren't scared enough of them to really hold back all their aggressive tendencies. And so, you know, last year I could have said that there has never been a convergence of storms that raised flood levels to record levels in New York, Long Island, and New Jersey, and therefore there never would be. The fact that there hasn't – but then Sandy, of course, would have proved that wrong. The fact that there hasn't been a horrible episode doesn't prove that it can't happen.
Mm. And that's your worry?
Yeah. I mean, I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis too.
Yes.
And, you know, the notion as a small boy standing there looking up into the sky and wondering when or if missiles were going to start falling out of the sky on me.
Will, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's get – oops, it looks like we missed we had someone waiting in the wings here. Let me ask you something. This has been perhaps an argument for why nuclear weapons can be defensive. And when President Bush talked about the axis of evil, he was talking about North Korea, which is certainly developing nuclear weapons. Iran certainly looking like it developing. And Iraq, which had nuclear weapons, but as we turned out, didn't have them when we invaded. Which country got invaded? You know, that was Iraq. And that is the argument that the threat of nuclear weapons or the idea that you might have nuclear weapons protects you at least from the United States. Does that hold water?
Well, there are some practical difficulties with it. North Korea has the fifth largest army in the world, or maybe it's the fourth now. They may be untrained and poorly equipped, but that's a lot of guys with guns. North Korea has particularly difficult terrain to fight over, which we know because we fought a war there. And the other problem is that whereas Iraq, of course, is flat and open and there's doesn't rain very much, so you always have clear skies for your jets and your drones and your, you know. Iraq is perfect for war, our kind of war.
Right. Perfect in quotations.
Perfect,
obviously.
Right, obviously. Gotcha. Effective. And North Korea also happens to have a friend nearby that in the past has shown that they're willing to come in and help them out, which is China. And so it might not be... It might be that if you invade North Korea, you end up fighting China, which is whereas Iraq didn't have that kind of ally waiting in the background. So there are all kinds of reasons why the comparison between Iraq and North Korea doesn't hold.
I think I read this correctly, that you predict that if all the nuclear armed countries were to give up these nuclear weapons, that France would be the last country to do it. And I'm curious why. Why France?
Well, sometimes when we're talking about nuclear weapons, we laugh about because it won't be Pakistan, it won't be Israel, it'll be France. And the reason is that nuclear weapons are deeply interwoven into the identity of France. France
really?
Without
nuclear... More than this country.
Maybe not more than this country, but we have this large, capable, conventional military that can stand in. That we could be proud of if we didn't have nuclear weapons. France, without nuclear weapons, is a middle-sized power with fabulous cuisine. And, you know, I think they would feel differently about themselves. They wouldn't be a great power anymore. They would be on the level of, you know, Brazil or Iran or something, and that's not how they think of themselves.
So kind of it gives them a kind of status that they have among world powers.
Yeah, and nuclear weapons basically are status symbols. That's one of their enormous political power in the world is because they serve as status symbols.
Mm. Let me get to, it looks like Jake to join us on Radio Times. And Jake, go ahead, you're on the air.
Jay, I was a second lieutenant or the company commander in South Korea when they took the Pueblo.
Oh, wow.
And I still remember that afternoon. We had a commander's hour at 4:30, and they said, get ready to deploy to the south, issue weapons tomorrow, and that they're going to shoot off the nuclear bombs up in those valleys coming from North Korea to stop the North Koreans. And everything was going to be cool because the radiation poisoning would kill those guys if the wind didn't shift.
Scary time, Jake.
That was our strategy. And, of course, that night the officers' club at 20th General Support Group was jammed. Everybody closed it. We figured that's the last time we're going to be going there.
Oh, my gosh. Jake, let me give Ward Wilson a chance to respond to your comment there, your story.
I think it illustrates the fundamental problem with nuclear weapons is that they are powerful, but they have this radiation that you can't control. The wind is unpredictable, and I'm glad I wasn't in your shoes, Jay.
Indeed, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. So are you opposed to nuclear weapons?
Well, I think they're dangerous and not very smart weapons. Mm. And I think think about it this way. Imagine that you and I had a bank and we wanted to hire a bank guard. And you said, you know, let's give him a uniform. And I said, yes. And then you said, we should give him a weapon. And I said, give him a billy club or that thing they in England where they. And then you said, something stronger. And I said, what about the strongest, most powerful weapon available? What about dynamite? Mm. And then we nodded our heads and said, okay, powerful weapon, great, good. Now, here's the bank lobby, and the guard has three sticks of dynamite in his belt, and here's the guy at the... There's a bad guy at the teller with a gun, and he says, give me the dough. What's the bank guard going to do? Is he going to light the dynamite and throw it and blow up the bad guy and the teller and the customers and the lobby and maybe himself. Problem with nuclear weapons is they're very powerful. It's not clear they're very useful. And if you have technology that's very dangerous but not very useful, why would you want to keep that technology?
Do you think Americans think about nuclear weapons or our arsenal or the threat of nuclear war? I mean, there's so many things, frankly, to worry about these days. And, yeah. Where in the hierarchy of anxiety do we put something like nuclear weapons?
We don't think about them in the way that we did in the 60s and 80s, I think. But they clearly are on people's minds because mm-hmm. we're worried about Iran. We're worried about North Korea. We know who's got nuclear weapons and who doesn't, and we care about that. So it's this funny relationship where we try not to think about them. They're in silos somewhere in the Midwest. But at the same time, they inform our political decisions and judgments. And I think we need to think more closely.
What would you advise President Obama?
I think it's a difficult problem because there's so little grassroots support in the U.S., but I think that there's a great deal that can be done. If the United States, for instance, issued an official report that said, we've revisited this nuclear weapon issue, they don't seem to be as useful as we once thought they were, I think that would be a large step into devaluing nuclear weapons around the world. Much harder to convince your local legislature to fund a nuclear weapons program if the United States is saying, these are weapons that we don't really think have much utility.
Well, on that note, Ward Wilson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. A very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and he's the author of a new book simply titled Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Artie Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for those phone calls as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back.